It's your time to Ed Up with America's leading higher education podcast network, the Ed Up Experience, where we make education your business. This is Ed Up Legal with your host, Patty Roberts. She's Dean at St. Mary's School of Law, and she's going to be leading conversations about legal education in today's world. Now let's hear from your host, Patty Roberts.
Welcome to Ed Up Legal. I'm Patty Roberts from St. Mary's University School of Law. And today we're talking with Elizabeth Kronk Warner. She is the Dean and a Professor of Law at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah, a position she has held since 2019. Welcome, Dean Warner.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. I'm very excited to talk with you about the cool new things that are going on at Utah Law. But I also wanted to talk a little bit about your path to becoming a dean. I know that you are a citizen of the Sault Ste. Marie tribe of the Chippewa Indians and served as an appellate judge and district judge in the past for tribes. And that you're nationally recognized expert in the intersection of environmental and Indian law. So those are unusual resume items for a dean. Please tell me a little bit about how you came to be the dean of the Quinney School of Law.
Yes, of course. Well, thank you. Thanks again for having me, Dean Roberts, and for this exciting conversation. So it's certainly true. Having native deans is somewhat unusual. To my knowledge, I'm only the third law school dean who's also been an enrolled member of the tribe. The other two were Stacy Leeds at the University of Arkansas and Kevin Washburn, who was at New Mexico and is now at Iowa. So I'm privileged to be in their company. So my path has been somewhat unusual. I certainly never started out thinking I wanted to be a dean. I started practicing Indian and environmental law and energy law in Washington, D.C. When I graduated from law school. I really enjoyed the practice of law, but kind of had a life-changing moment. My father died very early. He died when he was 56 from cancer. And it was life-changing from the perspective of it really forced me to reflect on what I wanted to do with my life. And I found that while I really enjoyed the practice of law, I did not particularly enjoy the hours that I was spending in the practice of law. I was with a large law firm in Washington, D.C. And so basically I was working 7 days a week and didn't have much of a social life or personal life to speak of. And so his death really kind of brought to the forefront what my priorities were and that I wanted to have more of a work-life balance and really give back to my tribal communities. And so around that time, I just happened to see a job opportunity at the University of Montana. That was a job in both Indian law and environmental law. So kind of my two loves, as you mentioned, I really enjoy the intersection of the two. And so I applied a bit on a whim. I had never been to Montana, but it sounded like a great job and kind of a great opportunity and a chance to reinvent myself following this new awakening. And I was fortunate enough to get that job. And so I joined the Academy in 2006 as an assistant professor at Montana and had the chance to teach both Indian law and environmental law. And it was a wonderful experience. I learned a lot and enjoyed that opportunity. I especially appreciated it because that's where I met my husband.
That worked out in all sorts of ways.
Yes. And so my desire to find a personal life did indeed work. But we left Montana after about 5 years, and then we went to Texas Tech University. And had a chance to work with a wonderful dean there, Darby Dickerson, who was really a great mentor to me. She left Texas Tech and she was dean at John Marshall, University of Illinois, Chicago, and she's currently dean at Southwestern. But she was really the first person who instilled in me this idea that, you know, women could be really strong deans and great leaders. and also started to take an interest in me in terms of mentoring, you know, talking to me about how much she enjoyed being an associate dean, for example. And it was the first time that I, maybe not seriously, but started to be on my radar screen that maybe I could do leadership. After Texas Tech University, we were fortunate. We got an opportunity for me to serve as director of the Tribal Law and Government Center at the University of Kansas, which was at the time my dream job. Funny enough, I followed Stacy Leeds. So I mentioned that Stacy Leeds was one of the other native deans. She had been director of the KU Tribal Law and Government Center, and then she left to become dean at the University of Arkansas. And that's when I got the directorship at KU. And so I always tease her because I'm always kind of a couple years behind her. So I say, okay, what are we doing? You know, what am I doing in 5 years? And
you know, what are we already have a blueprint then, right?
Yes, exactly. Yes. She is literally blazing the trail for me. So she moved into the deanship and I had an opportunity to take on the directorship. Served in the directorship for several years. And then my associate dean, who I'd become very close to and had become a great mentor to me, Melanie Wilson, went on to become the dean at the University of Tennessee. And she was the one who really said, hey, I think you can do this associate dean job. I think you'd be really good at it. I had never thought about it beforehand. As I mentioned, I had my dream job. I was running this great tribal law center, really enjoying that. But she convinced me, and she also convinced the dean at the University of Kansas, Steve Mamaza, that I'd be a good replacement for her. And so sure enough, he selected me to be his associate dean, and I served as his associate dean for several years. And he was an amazing mentor to me. And I really appreciate him because he is a white, heterosexual man. So he is not diverse in any category. But he is a wonderful ally and he recognizes the importance of diversity. Interestingly, I was the third of his associate deans to go on to become a dean. And the previous two were both female and diverse in some way. So Stacy Leeds was Native, and then Melanie Wilson identifies as LGBTQ. So I really appreciate him not only for mentoring me up, for teaching me things like budget and fundraising and having, you know, believing in me, but also really seeing kind of walking the walk in terms of being a good ally and promoting diverse women in particular. So I really loved my time with him. And then I got bit by the dean bug. So I actually applied for 5 deanships. Received 2 offers and obviously took the Utah offer. The first 2 deanships I applied for while I was on maternity leave, which I would not recommend because I'm not really sure what happened in those interviews. it's a bit of a blur. But I'm a firm believer in that things happen for the right reasons and you end up where you're meant to be. Because again, the University of Utah, I felt like was a long shot for me. I guess it's my imposter syndrome that I'm always working through, but I was really excited about it. It's a great law school. It's a great university. Salt Lake is a wonderful fit for myself and my family. We're closer to my husband, my husband's family, and we really like being outdoors. We like skiing, we like hiking. And so it was really nice for us to get back to the West. And I just really felt like it was a long shot, but I threw my hat in the ring and applied and somehow became a finalist, and ultimately got the offer, which was just amazing. And I felt so privileged. And so here we are in Salt Lake City. It's been 2.5 years at the University of Utah, and you know, never say never, but I think we're done. I think this will be it. So that was kind of my path. I never, like I said, never sought out to be a dean, and it didn't really come onto my radar screen until I'd been an associate dean for a couple of years and got the training. But really what I think the story of my path is amazing people who believed in me and who invested in me and mentored me and helped me see that I could do the job and that I could do the job well. And so I'm very, very thankful to them.
Well, I think you really hit the nail on the head. I love hearing about the women who blazed the trail for you and supported you, looked back and said, come on up, here's a hand and let me help you. Women whom I know that do this and have done the same with me or similar with me. And then that you have found a male ally who was training deans, as it were, training diverse female deans. That's a really terrific story. I'll share that when I was unsure if being a dean was for me, and I was starting to think, well, should I not? Kind of in the same reflective period that you were, and I'm sorry about the loss of your dad, by the way. It's something that really rocked my world too. And so then I think you start to really wonder and you prioritize, as you indicated. I went to a conference at UVA that was meant to increase diversity, gender diversity in particular, leadership in leadership in higher education. And I remember very well your presentation about the path that you just shared. And I thought, wow, look at this woman who was in five dean searches, my goodness, and went through them all with grace and strength and confidence and ended up exactly where she was meant to be. So you inspired me. So thank you for that.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I'm just a firm believer. Things work out for a reason.
I completely agree. I know that I was called to be here. For some reason, called to be here during a pandemic. But, you know, whatever. We roll with it.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. But now being a diverse dean, and I'm so glad you shared with me that you are the third Native dean. I think that's fantastic. And congratulations. I'm glad you're so happy where you are. And I know that you take very seriously the commitment of diversifying leadership in legal education and also in the profession. So tell me a little bit about how you've taken that priority, that personal priority, and infused it in your leadership at your law school. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Yeah. And I think that's part of, I always like to be open about the fact that I was a failed candidate three times. And two of those interviews, like I said, maternity leave, it was a bit of a blur. But, you know, the third law school that I interviewed for, I was a finalist. And when it came time to talk to the president, I was a little bit concerned about how my values and diversity, equity, inclusion aligned with the university, or would they align with the university? And so I asked questions about that, and I'll never know why I didn't get that deanship. The person who's in that deanship now is wonderful and doing a great job. But, you know, I always wonder if my questions about kind of my values around diversity, equity, and inclusion were the reason I didn't get the job. And I think that's why it's important to really lead with what's important to you, because you don't want to be in a job where there isn't alignment, especially deanships. I mean, deanship, that's a hard job. And you don't want to be in a place that where there isn't that vision alignment. And so it's working really well at the University of Utah. It's hard because, you know, I think any time that you come in and lead with a diversity, equity, and inclusion and accessibility vision, it's necessarily going to make people uncomfortable. It's going to make them uncomfortable because when you say things like, hey, why do we have a panel with no diverse folks on the panel? What are we telling our students? You know, people will get defensive. Oh, well, I'm not, you know, that's not what we mean, or this, that, and the other thing. Or when we look at our hiring practices and say, hi, you know, why are we not promoting in our hiring practices diverse folks? I think it's really easy for people to think that you are calling their morality into question. And that makes these conversations really, really difficult. And so that's another reason why I like to lead with, I have certainly made mistakes on the diversity, equity, and inclusion front. I have certainly put my foot in my mouth, said the wrong thing at the wrong time, and made mistakes. And I like to lead with that because that's normal. You know, the only thing that we're truly experts in is our own lived experience. And so we are necessarily going to make mistakes. But I think if we let that paralyze us, or if we let that stop us from making progress, we'll never get better. And so we need to have these conversations, but we need to also recognize that each of us is human and that we're going to make mistakes, and that we're not saying that the other person is inherently flawed or is inherently immoral. We're just saying you made a mistake. And I think that's a really important distinguishing factor to make. You know, we're all learners in some space. You know, I am an expert on what it is to be a female member of the Sault Ste. Marie Tribe of Chippewa Indians living off reservation. But I think that's all I can really claim an expertise in. I can't claim an expertise in anything else.
I don't know about that.
Well, but I'm just a learner in every other space, right? And so, and there might be some experiences that I'm a bit more educated on than others, but, you know, still ultimately a learner. And I think sometimes, especially in our profession, because so many law professors and administrators, we're all type A and we were all successful in law school and we're always scared of making a mistake and that can paralyze ourselves. And so we've really been working on, I like to say, a community where we can make mistakes. And the first time people will politely redirect you, point out your mistake, and then you can hopefully learn from it. Now, obviously, if you keep making the mistake over and over again, then we might have a bigger problem, but at least a community where people feel comfortable enough to learn from one another to have those open dialogues. So that's kind of our broad goal. And then we've been doing more systematic efforts. So on the accessibility front, we've really been looking at our website to make sure that it's accessible. We've been making sure that technology is available to all of our students. During the pandemic, obviously, we're very concerned about our students having Wi-Fi access and getting those types of things, but being very much aware of neurodiversity and also physical disability diversity and working on those fronts. And then in terms of racial diversity, we've made progress there. We've increased the diversity of our student body. So we were at 11%, we're up to 18%. Obviously still have progress to be made, but we're working on it. There's some stereotypes about Utah that are sometimes a challenge in terms of recruiting students. And so just demonstrating to students that we are a diverse body. But we've seen nice progress on the LGBTQIA front, where we have over 20% of our incoming students identify as LGBTQ. So we've made some progress specifically in that area, and then also in gender diversity. So for the first time, we've had majority female classes before, but for the first time, our law school is majority female. And that includes both our JD program and our MLS program. So we've definitely made changes there. And then that trickles over into our leadership team. So our senior admin team is 42% racially diverse. All of kind of our top positions are female. And so we've really worked at incorporating that diversity into our leadership as well. And then we're also leading out with programming because obviously that's important too. We want diverse folks to come and then to feel welcome. So really thinking about creating a community atmosphere and what that looks like. So things like co-locating student services all in the same location so we can really start to create that community feel. Having services and supports available for students. So for example, we have an embedded mental health counselor to support our students. And she's so busy, she's booked out 3 weeks.
Oh my goodness, yeah.
And so that's been, it's a very successful program in terms of it's very well used. And so we were also working on improving our programming in terms of our curriculum and adding new classes that look at diverse topics to the curriculum. So we're really approaching it from a wide angle in terms of how we promote diversity, equity, inclusion. And we've made some positive steps, but we definitely have a work to go. I joke that I have chosen a goal that can never be obtained because I don't think we will ever say we have succeeded in our diversity, equity, and inclusion and accessibility goals because there will always be something more to be done. But that's okay. As long as we're kind of moving the ball forward and we're making progress, I'm really excited about where we've come so far and kind of our vision for the future.
That is a tremendous amount of success in diversification. And you're right. You don't ever get to a point where you say, okay, like we can't say, oh yeah, we're a Hispanic serving institution. We're done. Like then
we're
people
done.
Are like, well, yeah. Where's everybody else? You know, so you have to be very intentional about it. But one thing that I love that you are sharing with your community is this affirming approach where mistakes are okay. I think you're right. People do, especially in this environment, get very nervous. They're going to say the wrong thing, do the wrong thing. But inaction doesn't move the needle either. Mm-hmm. So I applaud you for bringing that approach to your law school. So I know you're doing some cool things in addition to increasing diversity across a large swath of populations. You have two new programs debuting, a criminal law program and an intellectual property program. Can you share a little bit about those?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you. And we are excited about those. So we have two existing centers, one around environmental law and one around health and biomedical law. And so we're really excited to kind of pull together things that were already happening into a program and have individuals kind of oversee and steward those programs. So Professor Shima Baradaram-Boffman is overseeing our criminal law program. And then George Contreras is overseeing our intellectual property program. So it's really nice that we have faculty who are stepping up and who are excited to lead these programs. But yeah, bringing the resources together allows us to really do a couple of things that we weren't doing before. So having targeted goals for the program, doing fundraising for the program, hopefully creating new opportunities for students and for faculty, both in terms of research and for scholarships. And then also these are growth areas that we're experiencing currently in Salt Lake. So huge upswing in intellectual property. We have a new growing area. We call it Silicon Slopes, not to be Silicon Valley.
That's awesome.
Yes, because of the skiing here. But many tech firms are moving to the area. So Adobe, eBay, Qualtrics. And there seems to be a new one popping up every day. So IP is just a natural fit for Salt Lake City now. And then, you know, we have a lot of need for good criminal law attorneys, both kind of in conventional opportunities, but also one of the really exciting things that's happening in the state of Utah right now is access to justice initiatives, and specifically something that we call here a regulatory sandbox, where our Utah Supreme Court has said, you know, we're very concerned about this access to justice gap, where people are not getting the services they need. And a lot of those services are in the criminal space, not all, but a lot. And so the court is really challenging us to look creatively at these problems and say, you know, how can we come up with new and creative solutions to close this gap? And one of the things that they're allowing us to do is to provide services that are not necessarily provided by lawyers or not necessarily provided by entities owned by lawyers. And so that's allowed some of our grads, especially in the criminal space, to start to think about really creative things and even to implement. So for example, Noella Sudbury is working very hard on creating an app to expedite expungements. So we have a lot of people here in Utah, and I don't think it's unique to Utah, it's probably across the country, who are eligible for expungements, but they don't go through the process because it's Byzantine and it's really difficult to get things expunged. And so she's creating an app for that that walks people through the process. And I think that's a nice example of just some of the really cool work that could be done here, and that we can leverage our criminal law program to look at it, and then also some other work that we're doing in the access to justice space. So we're excited about these two new programs and to see if what happens in the future.
Well, it's great that you have a progressive Supreme Court that is interested in addressing these issues and giving you some latitude to do so. I've had the pleasure of talking to several of our colleagues at schools across the country that are also addressing access to justice through coding and through apps and other programs that I think really going to change the face of the practice of law, at least at the early stages where things can be more regulatory and mm-hmm. handled through things like apps. So I yeah. will look with great interest to see what you all come up with. I wanted to ask a couple of things just personally, you mentioned before we started that you enjoy skiing, and I think you're near to the Sundance Film Festival. Is that right? Yeah. Are these some of the, tell us about just the fun parts of living where you live.
Oh, of course. Although maybe I don't want to, because I don't want more people to move here.
Well, but if they're law students, right?
If they're law students, true. Yeah, we have, it's kind of funny. We have this joke in Utah, because Utah in the pandemic became very, very popular. We had these, we called them Zoom towns, because since people could work from anywhere during the pandemic, a lot of them moved to Utah because it's just such a beautiful state. I mean, we have the five national parks, and you kind of have a high desert environment in the south with really just gorgeous, unique features like Zion National Park, et cetera. But then here in the northern part of the state, we're along the Wasatch Front, and we have just world-class skiing. And it's truly amazing. I mean, I feel blessed to live here. So yes, I do. I love skiing. I'm not necessarily the best skier, but I do love it. And, you know, just to have, we have world-class resorts within 30 minutes of us. We have several different options. So every day we have the luxury of saying, which of these seven ski resorts should we go skiing at today?
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So it's just a bountiful riches in terms of skiing, and really nice. One of my, they say, you know, you live your life over again through your kids. And I have a 5-year-old son, and I had to learn skiing when I was in my 30s, which you really have to humble yourself when you're learning skiing in your 30s and all the little, like, you know, 3-year-olds are zipping past you. And so I really want my son to be a good skier. And so we'll just take him. We're like, okay, well, what bunny hill do we want to go to today? Because he can ski for free. And that's just so nice to just have that diversity of choices. But it's not just downhill skiing. We have amazing cross country skiing as well, which is really great. We still have the Olympic bobsled up. If anybody wants to come out and go bobsledding, that's always an option.
Oh, that's cool.
Yes. And so that's one of the things I love about Utah is within 5 minutes, I can be on a really nice trail here outside of Salt Lake. In fact, there's trails all around the university. 45 minutes, I can be in the wilderness. So this weekend, not only did we go skiing, but we also went out into the Uintas National Forest and cut down our Christmas tree. We had a permit. It was lawful.
I was going to say, is that okay?
We lawfully cut down a tree. But, you know, it's just a nice lifestyle. You know, one day we're skiing, the next day we're out in the national forest, kind of in the wilderness, cutting down a Christmas tree. And that's Utah for you. And then on top of it all, I went to a concert with the Trans-Siberian Orchestra. I'm a big Christmas buff. And so I love going to that orchestra. And I got to see that at the Vivint Center, which is where the jazz play. So I got to see this amazing concert on Wednesday night. I mean, these are all things that I did kind of over the long weekend. And that is really indicative of Salt Lake City. You get all the advantages of a big city, things like large concerts, the jazz, but then you can go skiing and you have your choice of world-class resorts. And then you can go out into the wilderness and go get your Christmas tree. And that's just what I love about Salt Lake City.
Well, that's a fantastic commercial for Salt Lake City. And I think I'm going to have to visit.
Speaking of Sundance, you know, we're hosting the anti-racism conference for deans in January. Come, it happens to be occurring at the same time as Sundance.
That is really cool. I have loved some of the same things about San Antonio and Texas, the just being out in nature and enjoying the state parks and the national parks. It's just beautiful. Mm-hmm. But we do not have skiing, I can tell you that.
Yeah, although I will say the Riverwalk in San Antonio is lovely. And I also love, I mean, the food, it's so good.
Oh, the food is good. And the kinds of entertainment you're talking about. I mean, it's a special place. But I have one last question, and that is regarding the future of legal education. And so I wanted to ask what your thoughts are about where legal education is heading in the next decade. And as part of this question, where is it likely to head, or where do you think it should head if that's different?
Mm-hmm. So I think there's a couple of things that we will definitely see happen in the next several years. So I think we're definitely going to see more online JD class offerings. You know, there was a lot of resistance to that pre-pandemic, but if there's one thing that we learned during the pandemic, it's that we can do legal education online, and maybe there needs to be a balance there between in-person and online, but I think probably all law schools moving forward will be doing more online offerings, I would imagine, after the pandemic. So I think that'll definitely happen. The other thing that I think we're going to see, the genie's kind of out of the box, if you will, is on the bar exam. A lot of states are seriously challenging and looking at alternative paths to licensure. And that's something I very much applaud them for. Several states did diploma privilege as a result of the pandemic. Utah was one of them. And, you know, the life went on. Our legal system did not implode. Those students who got diploma privilege under the emergency order are doing great work. And I think as more and more people see that, and also just there's this questioning of the validity of standardized testing, I really think that the day of the bar exam as the only path to licensure will be coming to an end. I think we'll probably see that in the next decade. There's enough push against it. And I think rightfully so. I personally believe that the bar exam is more of a test of access and privilege in terms of money to afford bar prep materials and money to support yourself while you study for the bar, rather than necessarily your capacity to be a good lawyer. So those are a couple of things that I definitely think we're going to see in the next 10 years. I also think there's increasingly going to be a push for diversification of the legal education in terms of not all focus on JD. A lot of law schools are looking at master's programs. A lot of states are looking at limited legal practitioner licensing where you don't necessarily have to be a lawyer. I think this goes back to the large access to justice gap that we have in the United States. And so really thinking creatively about, do we need everybody to be JDs, or could they maybe be a master's student and still do some legal work, or maybe even a bachelor's student and do some legal work, and really looking at that critically. And so I think we'll start to see more and more of those pushes moving forward. And then in terms of things that I would like to see, I think there will be moves towards trying to decrease the debt load. And so what that means for legal education and how that potentially could change it will be very interesting to see. And also the downstream effects related to that of the increasing starting salaries. Some firms are now at over 200,000 starting salaries. And what are going to be the downstream effects of that in terms of debt and cost of legal education? So I think that's where we'll start to see some movement, but I'm not quite sure what direction it will go in moving forward. So that'll be something to keep an eye on. So yes, lots of exciting things happening in the future. And I should mention one more thing. If I could change something, the other thing I would change is I would get rid of the U.S. News and World Report rankings.
Hear ye, hear.
I think there was almost nothing good in those rankings, except for maybe job placement rates, because obviously it's good to get our students jobs when they graduate. But otherwise, a lot of it perpetuates inequity. There's nothing in there that supports diversity. In fact, many of the factors are antagonistic to diversity. So for example, one of the factors that law schools get ranked on is percentage of students who have debt. Well, unless you're independently wealthy, you're probably going to take out some amount of loans. I know I certainly did during law school. And the students who tend to be independently wealthy and can afford to not take out loans tend to not be diverse. So you could see law schools trying to game that and have more students who are independently wealthy and don't need to take out loans. So that those types of things really don't promote diversity. And, you know, it's interesting, law is one of the few fields that almost solely relies on the US News rankings for our rankings. A lot of other areas like business has 10 different rankings. So I'd either like to see US News completely go or to be significantly diluted in value because we have other rankings to look at. But I would like to see that change because I don't think it does anything to help diversify the profession.
Yes, I think that it is very problematic and we struggle with some of the same issues. It's hard to increase access to the profession for those who are traditionally underrepresented when we have metrics that we're measured against that do not help that cause. It's funny, Law School Transparency did a report and they one of the proposals they gave about the rankings in US News suggested that the deans could get together and buy the rankings. And they like put a price tag on it, like what the value probably is to US News and everything. And I thought about throwing that out on the dean's listserv, but I changed my mind.
Oh, there you go. That's I have not thought of that one. That is an interesting
question. Well, I have really enjoyed our conversation, and I think your predictions are realistic and optimistic. And if some of them come to pass, then they will have tremendous impact on legal education and the profession. So thank you for your leadership.
Great. And thank you for the time. It's been a pleasure chatting with you. And I really appreciate your leadership and the opportunity to chat with you and to learn about all the great things happening at St. Mary's.
Thank you.
This has been another episode of EdUp Legal with your host, Patty Roberts. EdUp Legal is part of the EdUp Experience podcast network, bringing you the brightest and most influential minds across higher education and beyond. Here at EdUp, we make education your business.